A matter of trust. A talk given to a writing workshop in Vancouver, Washington, February 2002. In order to write a story, you have to trust yourself, you have to trust the story, and you have to trust the reader. Before you start writing, neither the story nor the reader even exists, and the only thing you have to trust is yourself. And the only way you can come to trust in yourself as a writer is to write, to commit yourself to that craft, to be writing, to have written, to work on writing, to plan to write, to read, to write, to practice your trade, to learn your job, until you know something about it and know you know something about it. This can be tricky. I have an 11-year-old pen pal who has written half a story and is now demanding that I put him in touch with my agent and a publisher. It is my very disagreeable duty to tell him that he hasn't quite earned that much trust in himself as a writer yet. On the other hand, I know some very good writers who never finish anything, or finish it and then destroy it with over-revising to meet real or imagined criticisms, because they don't trust themselves as writers, which means they can't trust their writing. Confidence in yourself as a writer is pretty much the same as all other kinds of confidence, the confidence of a plumber, or a school teacher, or a horseback rider. You earn it by doing. You build it up slowly by working at it. And sometimes, particularly when you're new at the game, you fake it. You act like you know what you're doing, and maybe you can get away with it. Sometimes if you act as if you were blessed, you will be blessed. That, too, is part of trusting oneself. I think it works better for writers than it does for plumbers. So much for trusting oneself. Now, to trust the story, what does that mean? To me, it means being willing not to have full control over the story as you write it, which would explain why it takes so long to learn to write. First, you have to learn how to write English and learn how to tell stories in general, techniques, practice, all that, so that you are in control. And then you have to learn how to relinquish it. Let me say here that many writers and teachers of writing would disagree strongly with what I'm saying. They'd say, you don't learn how to ride a horse, control the horse, make it do what you want it to do, and then take off its bridle and ride it bareback without reins. That's stupid. However, that is what I recommend. Taoism is always stupid. For me, it's not enough to be a good rider. I want to be a centaur. I don't want to be the rider controlling the horse. I want to be both the rider and the horse. How far to trust your story? It depends on the story, and your own judgment and experience are the only guide. The only generalizations I'm willing to make are these. Lack of control over a story, usually arising from ignorance of the craft or from self-indulgence, may lead to slackness of pace, incoherence, sloppy writing, spoiled work. Overcontrol, usually arising from self-consciousness or a competitive attitude, may lead to tightness, artificiality, self-conscious language, dead work. Deliberate, conscious control, in the sense of knowing and keeping to the plan, the subject, the gate, and the direction of the work, is invaluable in the planning stage, before writing, and in the revision stage, after the first draft. During the actual composition, it seems to be best if conscious intellectual control is relaxed. An insistent consciousness of the intention of the writing may interfere with the process of writing. The writer may get in the way of the story. This is not as mystical as it sounds. All highly skilled work, all true craft and art, is done in a state where most aspects of it have become automatic through experience, through total familiarity with the medium, whether the medium is the sculptor's stone, or the drummer's drum, or the body of the dancer, or, for the writer, word sounds, word meanings, sentence rhythm, syntax, and so on. The dancer knows where her left foot goes, and the writer knows where the comma's needed. The only decisions a skilled artisan or artist makes while working are aesthetic ones. Aesthetic decisions are not rational. They're made on a level that doesn't coincide with rational consciousness. Thus, in fact, many artists feel they're in something like a trance state while working, and that in that state they don't make the decisions. The work tells them what needs doing, and they do it. Perhaps it is as mystical as it sounds. To go back to my horse metaphor, a good cowboy on a good horse rides with a loose rein and doesn't keep telling the horse what to do because the horse knows. The cowboy knows where they're going, but the horse knows how to get them there. I hope I don't sound like one of those bearers of glad tidings to writers who announce that there's nothing to it. Just shut down your intellect and free up your right brain and emit words. I have enormous respect for my art as an art and my craft as a craft, for skill, for experience, for hard thought, for painstaking work. I hold those things in reverence. I respect commas far more than I do congressmen. People who say that commas don't matter may be talking about therapy or self-expression or other good things, but they're not talking about writing. They may be talking about getting started, leaping over timidity, breaking through emotional log jams, but they're still not talking about writing. If you want to be a dancer, find out how to use your feet. If you want to be a writer, find out where the comma goes. Then worry about all that other stuff. Now, let's say I want to write a story. Speaking for myself personally, that can be taken for granted. I always want to write a story. There never is anything I'd rather do than write a story. In order to write that story, first I have learned how to write English and how to write stories by doing it quite regularly. I have also learned that what I need, once the story gets going, is to relinquish conscious control. Get my damned intentions and theories and opinions out of the way and let the story carry me. I need to trust it. But as a rule, I can trust the story only if there has been a previous stage of some kind, a period of approach. This may well involve conscious planning, sitting and thinking about the setting, the events, the characters, maybe making notes. Or it may involve a long, semi-conscious gestation during which events and characters and moods and ideas drift around half-formed, changing forms in a kind of dreamy limbo of the mind. And I do mean long, years sometimes. But then at other times, with other stories, this approach stage is quite abrupt. A sudden vision or a clear sense of the shape and direction of the story comes into the mind, and one is ready to write. All these approach states or stages may occur at any time, at your desk, walking on the street, waking up in the morning, or when your mind ought to be on what Aunt Julia is saying, or the electricity bill, or the stew. You may have a whole grandiose James Joyce epiphany thing, or you may just think, oh yes, I see how that'll go. The most important thing I have to say about this preliminary period is don't rush it. Your mind is like a cat hunting. It's not even sure yet what it's hunting. It listens. Be patient, like the cat. Very, very attentive. Alert. But patient. Slow. Don't push the story to take shape. Let it show itself. Let it gather impetus. Keep listening. Make notes or whatever if you're afraid you'll forget something, but don't rush to the computer. Let the story drive you to it. When it's ready to go, you'll know it. And if, like most of us, your life isn't all your own, if you haven't got time to write at that moment when you know the story's ready to be written, don't panic. It's just as tough as you are. It's yours. Make notes, think about your story, hang on to it, and it will hang on to you. When you find or make the time to sit down to it, it will be there waiting for you. Then comes the trance-like, selfless, rather terrifying, devouring work or play of composition, which is very difficult to talk about. About planning and composition, I want to make one observation, that it's delightful for a writer to be sheltered and shielded while at this intense work, given solitude and freedom from human responsibilities, like Proust in his padded cell, or the people who keep going to writers' colonies and having their lunch brought in a basket, delightful indeed, but dangerous, because it makes a luxury into a condition of work, a necessity. What you need as a writer is exactly what Virginia Woolf said, enough to live on and a room of your own. It's not up to other people to provide either of those necessities. It's up to you, and if you want to work, you figure how to get what you need to do it. What you live on probably has to come from daily work, not writing. how dirty your room gets is probably up to you. That the door of the room is shut and when and for how long is also up to you. If you have work to do, you have to trust yourself to do it. A kind spouse is invaluable. A fat grant, an advance on spec, a session at a retreat may be a tremendous help, but it's your work, not theirs, and it has to be done on your terms, not theirs. All right, so you shut the door and you write down a first draft at white heat because that energy has been growing in you all through the pre-writing stage and when released at last is incandescent. You trust yourself and the story and you write. So now it's written. You sit around and feel tired and good and look at the manuscript and savor all the marvelous, wonderful bits. Then it cools down and you cool down and arrive, probably somewhat chilled and rueful, at the next stage. Your story is full of ugly, stupid bits. You distrust it now, and that's as it should be, but you still have to trust yourself. You have to know that you can make it better. Unless you're a genius or have extremely low standards, composition is followed by critical, patient revision, with the thinking mind turned on. I can trust myself to write my story at white heat without asking any questions of it, if I know my craft through practice, if I have a sense of where this story's going, and if when it's got there, I'm willing to turn right round and go over it and over it, word by word, idea by idea, testing and proving it till it goes right, till all of it goes right. Parenthetically, this is the period when it is most useful to have criticism from others, in a peer group or a class or from professional editors. Informed, supportive criticism is invaluable. I am a strong believer in the workshop as a way of gaining confidence and critical skills not only before you get published, but also for experienced professional writers. And a trustworthy editor is a pearl beyond price. To learn to trust your readers, and which readers to trust, is a very great step. Some writers never take it. I will return to that subject in a moment. To sum up, I have to trust the story to know where it's going, and after I've written it, I have to trust myself to find out where it or I got off track and how to get it all going in one direction in one piece. And only after all that, usually long after, will I fully know and be able to say what, in fact, the story was about and why it had to go the way it went. Any work of art has its reasons, which reason does not wholly understand. When a story's finished, it's always less than your vision of it was before it was written. But it may also do more than you knew you were doing, say more than you realized you were saying. That's the best reason of all, to trust it, to let it find itself. To conceive a story or manipulate it to make it serve a purpose outside itself, such as an ambition to be famous, or an agent's opinion about what will sell, or a publisher's wish for instant profit, or even a noble end, such as teaching or healing, is a failure of trust, of respect for the work. Of course, almost all writers compromise here to some extent. Writers are professionals in an age when capitalism pretends to be the arbiter of good. They have to write for the market. Only poets totally and sublimely ignore the market and therefore live on air and fellowships. Writers want to right wrongs or bear witness to outrages or convince others of what they see as truth. But insofar as they let such conscious aims control their work, they narrow its potential scope and power. That sounds like the doctrine of art for art's sake. I don't offer it as a doctrine, but as a practical observation. Somebody asked James Clerk Maxwell in 1820 or so, what is the use of electricity? And Maxwell asked right back, what is the use of a baby? What's the use of To the Lighthouse? What's the use of War and Peace? How would I dare try to define it, to limit it? The arts function powerfully in establishing and confirming human community. Story, told or written, certainly serves to enlarge understanding of other people and of our place in the world as a whole. Such uses are intrinsic to the work of art, integral with it. But any limited, conscious, objective purpose is likely to obscure or deform that integrity. Even if I don't feel my skill and experience are sufficient, and they are never sufficient, I must trust my gift, and therefore trust the story I write, know that its use, its meaning or beauty, may go far beyond anything I could have planned. A story is a collaboration between teller and audience, writer and reader. Fiction is not only illusion, but collusion. Without a reader, there's no story. No matter how well written, if it isn't read, it doesn't exist as a story. The reader makes it happen just as much as the writer does. Writers are likely to ignore this fact, perhaps because they resent it. The relationship of writer and reader is popularly seen as a matter of control and consent. The writer is the master who compels, controls, and manipulates the reader's interest and emotion. A lot of writers love this idea. And lazy readers want masterful writers. They want the writer to do all the work while they just watch it happen, like on TV. Most bestsellers are written for readers who are willing to be passive consumers. The blurbs on their covers often highlight the coercive, aggressive power of the text, compulsive page-turner, gut-wrenching, jolting, mind-searing, heart-stopping. What is this, electroshock torture? From commercial writing of this type and from journalism come the how-to-write cliches. Grab your readers with the first paragraph. Hit them with shocker scenes. Never give them time to breathe, and so on. Now, a good many writers, particularly those entangled in academic programs in fiction, get their intellect and ego so involved in what they're saying and how they're saying it that they forget that they're saying it to anyone. If there's any use in the grab 'em and wrench their guts out school of advice, it's that it at least reminds the writer that there is a reader out there to be grabbed and gutted. But just because you realize your work may be seen by somebody other than the professor of creative writing, you don't have to go into attack mode and release the Rottweilers. There's another option. You can consider the reader not as a helpless victim or a passive consumer, but as an active, intelligent, worthy collaborator, a colluder, a co-illusionist. Writers who choose to try to establish mutual trust believe it is possible to attract readers' attention without verbal assault and battery. Rather than grab, frighten, coerce, or manipulate a consumer, collaborative writers try to interest a reader, to induce or seduce people into moving with the story, participating in it, joining their imagination with it. Not a rape, a dance. Consider the story as a dance, the reader and writer as partners. The writer leads, yes, but leading isn't pushing. It's setting up a field of mutuality where two people can move in cooperation with grace. It takes two to tango. Readers who have only been grabbed, bashed, gut-wrenched, and electroshocked may need a little practice in being interested. They may need to learn how to tango. Once they've tried it, they'll never go back among the pit bulls. Finally, there is the difficult question of audience. In the mind of the writer planning or composing or revising the work, what is the presence of the potential reader or readers? Should the audience for the work dominate the writer's mind and guide the writing? Or should the writer, while writing, be utterly free of such considerations? I wish there were a simple soundbite answer, but actually this is a terribly complicated question, particularly on the moral level. Being a writer, conceiving a fiction, implies a reader. Writing is communication, though that's not all it is. One communicates to somebody, and what people want to read influences what people want to write. Stories are drawn out of writers by the spiritual and intellectual and moral needs of the writer's people. But all that operates on a quite unconscious level. Once again, it's useful to see the writer's work as being done in three stages. In the approach stage, it may be essential to think about your potential audience. Who is this story for? For instance, is it for kids? Little kids? Young adults? Any special, limited audience calls for specific kinds of subject matter and vocabulary. All genre writing, from the average formula romance to the average New Yorker story, is written with an audience in mind. An audience so specific it can be called a market. Only the very riskiest kind of fiction is entirely inconsiderate of the reader/market, saying, as it were, I will be told, and somebody, somewhere, will read me. Probably 99% of such stories end up, in fact, unread, and probably 98% of them are unreadable. The other 1 or 2% come to be known as masterpieces, usually very slowly, after the brave author has long been silent. Consciousness of audience is limiting, both positively and negatively. Consciousness of audience offers choices, many of which have ethical implications, Puritanism or porn, shock the readers or reassure them, do something I haven't tried or do my last book over, and so on. The limitations imposed by aiming at a specific readership may lead to very high art. All craft is a matter of rules and limitations, after all. But if consciousness of audience as market is the primary factor controlling your writing, you are a hack. There are arty hacks and artless hacks. Personally, I prefer the latter. All this has been about the approach stage, the what am I going to write stage. Now that I know, dimly or exactly, who I'm writing for, anything from my granddaughter to all posterity, I start writing. And now, at the writing stage, consciousness of audience can be absolutely fatal. It is what makes writers distrust their story, stick, block, start over and over, never finish. Writers need a room of their own, not a room full of imaginary critics all watching over their shoulders saying, is thee a good way to start that sentence? An overactive internal aesthetic censor, or the external equivalent, what my agent or my editor is going to say, is like an avalanche of boulders across the story's way. During composition, I have to concentrate entirely on the work itself, trusting and aiding it to find its way with little or no thought of what or who it's for. But when I get to the third stage, revision and rewriting, it reverses again. Awareness that somebody's going to read this story and of who might read this story becomes essential. What's the goal of revision? Clarity, impact, pace, power, beauty. All things that imply a mind and heart receiving the story. Revision clears unnecessary obstacles away so the reader can receive the story. That is why the comma is important, and why the right word, not the approximately right word, is important, and why consistency is important, and why moral implications are important, and all the rest of the stuff that makes a story readable makes it live. In revising, you must trust yourself, your judgment, to work with the receptive intelligence of your potential readers. You also may have to trust specific, actual readers, spouse, friends, workshop peers, teachers, editors, agents. You may be pulled between your judgment and theirs, and it can be tricky to arrive at the necessary arrogance or the necessary humility or the right compromise. I have writer friends who simply cannot hear any critical suggestions. They drown them out by going into defensive explanation mode. Oh, yes, but see what I was doing. Are they geniuses or just butt-headed? Time will tell. I have writer friends who accept every critical suggestion uncritically and end up with as many different versions as they have critics. If they meet up with bullying, manipulative agents, and editors, they're helpless. What can I recommend? Trust your story. Trust yourself. Trust your readers, but wisely. Trust watchfully, not blindly. Trust flexibly, not rigidly. The whole thing, writing a story, is a high-wire act. There you are, out in midair, walking on a spiderweb line of words, and down in the darkness, people are watching. What can you trust but your sense of balance?